Welcome to the Daily Real Estate Investor Podcast. I'm your host, Josiah Smelser. The Daily Real Estate Investor Podcast is the shared journey of building a real estate investment property business from square one. Join me as we learn together how to conquer the real estate game to reach financial freedom. Together, we will learn from people in all areas of real estate and business in our personal trek towards escaping the rat race. Be you. Do the work you love. Play the long game. Before we get going, make sure you're subscribed to the show on whatever audio platform you're using and jump over on YouTube and subscribe to our YouTube channel, The Daily Real Estate Investor. We have shorts coming out daily as well as these podcast episodes on video. Hey guys, we're back for another episode of The Daily Real Estate Investor Podcast. I am excited about this one because I'm very interested in the topic we're going to cover today, which is going to be specifically multifamily. And we've got one of my buddies, Axel Ragnarsson, on the show. Axel, welcome.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, man. I've been actually meaning to have you on the show since I started the podcast a while back, and I took a break from it, but you were one of the top people on my list to get on the show, so I'm glad we're finally making this happen.
No, I appreciate the invite, and I'm glad to be on for sure.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you located? What are you working on these days? What's your focus with real estate investing?
For sure. Yeah. So I live in Boston, Massachusetts. Grew up in New Hampshire. So I've always been in the Northeast. I've always been in New England. The very quick spark notes on how I got into real estate. So I grew up in an entrepreneurial family. My parents ran a wood chipping company. So Nothing to do with real estate, but was like exposed to business ownership pretty early on and always had that entrepreneurial kind of bone. And throughout high school and early college, I had a little side business where I was buying and selling cars. And I remember at the time I was like, you know, this isn't going to be like the forever business or the forever thing. I got to figure out a way to make some money after I, you know, get out of school and what comes next and all that. Knew I didn't really want to go the traditional corporate route. That just really wasn't for me. I had a job right after I graduated for 3 days before I just told the guy that hired me, I was like, hey, this just really is not for me. So I immediately quit and got my license and started brokering real estate. Did that for about a year. But while I was doing all of this, I was really, really intent on building my own real estate portfolio. And for me at the time, I was like, you know, should I flip houses? Should I wholesale houses? I knew I wanted to be in real estate. I, you know, seen all the HGTV shows, listened to a bunch of podcasts. And while I was learning about flipping houses, wholesaling, and all of the transactional strategies, I learned about multifamily real estate and rental real estate and passive income and all that. And I said, hey, that seems like a pretty good deal. You find a piece of real estate and you buy it at a good price. You can get your money out and you're in the tenants there. They pay the mortgage, they pay the rents. You got some money left over. Let's go do that. So I got really intentional about finding small off-market deals or small multifamily deals off-market. So I started sending mailers. I started doing some cold calling. I was prospecting too for rent ads. And that was really how I started the business, was finding these small 3-4 unit deals through those mediums. Financed a lot of them with private money at the time. You know, this is 2017, 2018, 2019. Started building a portfolio and eventually got to the point where I didn't need to broker real estate for money and had a portfolio of these smaller multifamily assets that, you know, was kind of paying for my lifestyle at the time. And then around 2020 or so, got to a point where I was getting a little... It was a little bit risky running that strategy over and over in terms of using a lot of private money and funding renovations out of pocket, not really having a lot of reserves. And then, you know, it started to feel like a bit of a house of cards. So I wanted to slow down what I was doing with my own money, and I wanted to start raising money so that I could, you know, grow a little bit more predictably and safely. And so at the time I started learning about syndication, I started learning about, you know, joint venture partnerships, how you can start raising equity and partnering with investors, really dove deep into that world. And at the time as well, I wanted to start doing slightly larger deals, which for me at the time I defined as, you know, 20 to 80 unit multifamily deals. Realistically, it was going to be 20, 30, 40 unit deals. That was like big for me at the time. And so I started looking out of state as well. So everything I had done up to that point was in New Hampshire. I was living in Boston and, you know, New Hampshire being about an hour north of Boston. So I was looking in New Hampshire, then I started looking down in Florida because I had a friend that moved to Tampa and, you know, read every single article on Wall Street Journal and Forbes and Bigger Pockets about how everybody's going to Florida. So I said, hey, I should, you know, start looking for deals down there. So kept doing all the direct-to-seller stuff and eventually started taking down some of these mid-sized multifamily deals with investor capital. We did a handful of deals in Florida in 2021 and 2022. And then at the same time, we were doing larger deals up in New Hampshire. We started a property management company in New Hampshire at that time as well. So we brought all of our operations in-house, all our management, you know, under our umbrella. And that's really where the business started to scale. So before that, I had, you know, 50, 60 units that I owned. And then we very quickly bought a couple hundred units in 21, a couple hundred units in 2022, we got to 400 units or so, you know, at the end of 22. We've since been selling some property off, but that was really what drove the business. And now that's really what we are as a business, where we go out there, we look for mid to, you know, mid-size to large multifamily deals. We really prioritize going direct to seller and finding discounted off-market deals. Really, really prioritize operations. And then we raise capital from passive investors to do so through various different structures, you know, typically the syndication structure. So we service passive investors, and we like to think we're, you know, excellent operators and excellent deal finders. And that's what our business has become today.
Good deal. The lot to unpack there, a lot of really, really valuable things along the way that you built, you basically built your system with, one of which was private money. I've also used private money. Tony's used private money. It's so important, I think, as an investor that you learn how to properly use private money. You don't want to take on too much risk. Like you don't want to, like you're saying, you don't want to, when you get to the point where you're feeling like it's a house of cards, you obviously want to get things balanced. And balance is the key with real estate investing. You want leverage, but you don't want too much leverage. You want private money, but you don't want to misuse private money, right? And I'm curious, and you said you've prioritized going direct to seller. I'm curious, are you also working with brokers trying to find properties? Are you 95% of this coming direct to seller?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We should be doing more in terms of establishing relationships with brokers. Like, we don't do nearly enough of that. And we are still on you know, the broker's radar in terms of the markets where we're really active. You know, Southern New Hampshire, Central New Hampshire, and Central Florida. You know, and in Florida, we prioritize Lakeland, Winter Haven, kind of the Bartow area between both Tampa and Orlando, right? That's really the I-4 corridor is where we focus. And we're relatively top of mind with active brokers in those markets. Now, we so rarely see deals that work for us that we don't invest a lot of time building those relationships. I mean, quite frankly, that's really what it is. And we're pretty good at the direct to seller thing, right? We're pretty good at staying top of mind with deal finders in our market, whether those are attorneys or GCs or property managers or insurance brokers or lenders or whoever, right? And then obviously we go direct to seller as well through marketing and prospecting. We have enough deal flow there to not have to rely on brokers. So we should do a better job at that, long story short, because that is really where you find the big deals. You know, big deals I'm defining right now is $6, $7, you know, $8 million plus. When you're getting to that 75, 80, 100 plus unit mark, those deals are primarily brokered. The reality is that like our cost of capital right now is still a little bit too high in terms of the investors that we're bringing into our deals would like to learn a little bit more on their money than what makes sense for us to raise to go buy those larger deals that are brokered, because we're just competing with everybody who has a lower cost of capital or who isn't as experienced on the operational side. And one of the curses of being in this game for a long period of time, because now, you know, we've been in it for 8 years now, is we own a management company, like we operate multifamily assets, we're on the operations side. We know exactly how much it costs to operate all of our properties. So when we underwrite deals, we don't underwrite them through the broker's lens. We don't underwrite them through this optimistic lens, which is what a lot of inexperienced buyers do. And those are the buyers that we're competing with. So we can't underwrite to the same level of returns that other buyers can. So we just lose deals that are brokered. So we've stopped investing a lot of time in that because it's just not necessarily worth our time. And it's just more profitable for us to build our direct to seller machine and to just try and establish relationships with people that are spending all of their time on building those broker relationships. And then we can just come in and joint venture on deals. So this is a long-winded answer to your question, but we don't do as much of it as we should. It's kind of a priority in our business right now to get better at it. But like, you know, especially now as we're recording this early June of 2023, like I haven't seen a broker deal this year that is even remotely close. Like regularly deals coming out at $3, $4 million and we're $500,000-$700,000 off list price. We're at 80% of the ask. Like, it's just, we're so far that there's no point in trying to see more of them, because we're just coming up with new ways to say, we're not even close. This isn't really for us. So we're just investing much more heavily on going direct to sellers. And that works for our acquisition criteria, which is that mid-size, right? That 30 to 80 units, where you can still have success going direct to seller.
That's interesting. I know commercial real estate is getting hit really, really hard. So two questions. I'll ask the first one. How are you guys, besides, going off market with the deals, how are you guys, has your underwriting changed for 2023?
Yeah, it's changed in a few different ways. You know, I think I'll just start rattling off some things in my head that come to mind here. Operational expenses are higher than they have been. Insurance costs are higher. Utility costs are higher. Any type of labor, whether that's on the CapEx side or on like the maintenance side on an ongoing basis, that's more expensive. So you got to make sure you're underwriting your operating expenses correctly. And this is really applicable to folks doing deals in Texas and the Southeast, where insurance costs have gone absolutely banana land. And in a state like Texas, where property taxes reassess every year, there are so many investors that are just losing properties because they didn't underwrite property tax reassessment, which is like investor, like underwriting 101. And a lot of investors didn't do that because there was a gold rush to Texas in the multifamily sector. And a lot of folks are like, all right, I underwrote, you know, taxes at 30 grand and now they're 45K. And my insurance has also gone up 40%. There's no amount of rent growth that can really bail you out of that. So got to get the expense side of the P&L right in your pro forma. Now on the rent side, which is the most important thing to get right in your underwriting, stabilized rents and rent growth drive almost all of your projected returns, assuming that you get relatively close on the expense side and on the debt side, right? In terms of, you know, what you're actually going to have on the debt side and then what you're actually going to operate the property at from an expense standpoint. So got to make sure you underwrite your stabilized rents correctly. Rents aren't growing at the level they used to, so you should be underwriting your stabilized rents after your value add a year into the future, 2 years in the future, depending on the deal that you're doing, at current market rents and ideally with a little bit of a discount. We're seeing rent growth really starting to flatten off in a lot of the markets that we look at deals in. And if you look at various markets throughout the country where there's been a bit of a supply overcorrection, like Phoenix, Austin, Tampa, there's been all kinds of new development to try and, you know, keep up with the population growth, and the markets have been really hot and developers overbuilt. So now rent growth is going, there's no rent growth, right? There's rent declines, right? Rent's going the other way. So if you're doing deals in those markets, you need to underwrite rents that are lower than what the current market is, or else you're going to be in a tricky spot. And, that's less of a problem in our markets because supply hasn't been as big of an issue. But to make a long story short, you got to get your rents right. You got to get your expenses right. And then on the debt side, just don't lose the property to the bank, right? And so how do you do that? You should probably be using fixed rate debt with a longer maturity period. You should probably not get into a loan product that has a maturity in the next couple of years, next few years. You know, use a loan product that's got a maturity date at least 5 years out, right? At least get a 5-year term, ideally a 10-year term. Because if you look back into the, you know, early 2010s after the GFC, most multifamily defaults were literally most, like over 50% of multifamily defaults from a loan standpoint were because of balloons. It was just people, their debt coming due at the wrong time. So you don't want to put yourself in a position where you're going to have to sell or have to refi. So everything we buy now is, you know, fixed rate financing, where if it's not cash flow positive from day one, we have a very clear roadmap, you know, through our value add to getting to, a really nice debt service coverage ratio at really, you know, conservative rents, conservative expense assumptions, and to where we're not going to have any balloon risk. So that's really what we're doing. And outside of that, we just got to operate really well. Like, underwriting is one part, but actually operating the property to achieve what you're underwriting is a whole nother thing. And we're investing in people and systems and tech and like really dialing in the operations, because nobody has been forced to be even remotely competent at operations over the last 4 or 5 years. If you bought a property, unless you are a complete whack job, like, you probably are going to be doing fine, right? Because the cost of capital is so low, the market was just going nuts. So, you know, we want to keep our vacancy periods down. We want to stay on budget from a CapEx standpoint. We want to make sure our renewal rate's high. We want to make sure we're conserving water and sewer and you know, managing our utility spend. Make sure that rents are staying at market, all of that different stuff. So probably give you more than you ask, but that's how we're looking at deals right now. And I think if we check those boxes and we hold on for a long enough period of time, we should be okay.
Yeah, no, and that's really good. I mean, everything you just mentioned, we can probably have 5 episodes just off of that clip that you just mentioned. But that's where, I mean, for our listeners, that's where a lot of the investors, the operators are going to get burned, because they open their underwriting thinking we're going to have an optimistic market. And this is obviously, this is what happens. But, you know, Axel, and your team, you guys look at it from a different standpoint. We're not going to change our underwriting because we know how this can hurt us in the future. However, let's change our strategy of what do we focus on. And that's what you guys did, focus more off market, because you cannot compete with what's on the market. So that's awesome, yeah, man.
And the last thing I'll mention on this before maybe we switch, you know, or go in a different direction, is we're just looking at smaller deals. And I think everybody likes to grow, right? Everybody wants to do bigger deals. They want to grow their business. They want to, you know, et cetera, right? We would love to do that. We would love to exclusively be doing large multifamily deals. Quite frankly, we just don't feel comfortable doing large deals right now. I would much rather do a handful of smaller 20-unit deals than, you know, one big 80-unit deal right now, because if something goes wrong on one of them, like, we can come out of pocket with some cash to, you know, to kind of bridge the gap between, you know, maybe we have like a, you know, a unit reno that goes over budget, or we have some systems that fail and it's, you know, much outside of our CapEx scope. We can come in as like the general partner or the owner of that deal and stopgap that without having to go to our investors or something like that. And smaller deals means that there's less execution risk, right? There's a smaller likelihood that something goes wrong on a 20 unit deal than a 100 unit deal. It's just less units, right? It's just, there's less moving parts. So we're doing smaller deals, despite the fact that we feel like we're almost overqualified to do them. And you know, for me, it's like, I'd like to do the big deals. I want to keep growing the business, but trying to, you know, flex that discipline muscle of, that's okay. Let's really stay in our zone of competence. Let's do the small stuff that we have a lot of experience doing, a lot of reps in, and you know, we'll save the pursuit of the larger ones for when we feel a little bit more comfortable with where the market's going.
And I think you guys are so smart for underwriting your rents a little bit lower than maybe you could, because that just gives you a more conservative approach, which obviously in a time of risk where thing, you know, we got raising interest rates, we've got higher insurance costs, massively higher insurance costs, then we've got the cost of renovations way up, and there's much more uncertainty. So that's that big risk factor everyone's always trying to estimate in their numbers. So when you're approaching analysis on a deal, whether it be a single family property, a multifamily property, mobile home park, whatever it is, you got to know where you are in the market cycle, properly assess the risk, and then, you know, you want to bake that into your numbers, and you don't want to be caught overestimating things, right? So folks bought multifamily a couple years ago, within the last couple years, they didn't properly estimate their taxes, like you're saying. There's no way they could have known insurance was going to go up 40%, right? Those yeah. people are in a really bad spot right now. And I, you know, you're much more in tune with this than I am, but I'm just kind of waiting for these properties to go belly up, because I know the investors are got to be upset. There's no way they're getting the returns that they thought they were going to get. I know the syndicators are probably sweating bullets. So what's going to happen with all this? I mean, do you see a lot of these properties being taken back over by the bank and going back up for sale? Are cap rates going to go up and prices come down? And is this going to, you know, adjust? Or what do you see coming for the next 5 years with all this?
I, you know, everything I say, big grain of salt, big asterisk,
yeah,
just
sure.
a dude on a podcast.
Yeah, sure.
In terms of what we think is going to happen, first of all, I think that there's a lot of folks online, whether it's on podcasts or Instagram or, I love Bigger Pockets. I came up on Bigger Pockets. That's how I learned everything I knew initially about the real estate business. Bigger Pockets pushes an agenda, right? They want to get people into real estate. You know, they want to be optimistic. I saw a podcast released on the main feed the other day talking about how now is the best time to buy multifamily because of all the facts that we're talking about. You know, interest rates are up. People don't want to buy, you know, strike when there's, you know, blood in the streets. There's no blood in the streets yet. We haven't seen real distress yet.
It might be their blood in the streets, right? If you strike, well, there's no, thinking there's blood in the streets and there's not, it might be yours. So,
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's very true. You know, like I said, we do deals in two very different markets with very different fundamentals. Southern New Hampshire, which is like the greater Boston area, the Northeast, Central Florida, two very different, you know, they're like night and day. And that's why we do deals in both of them, because they complement each other well. They have different, you know, fundamental, you know, demographics, metrics, just dynamics, et cetera. In the Northeast, we haven't seen pricing really move at all. Like, there hasn't been any distress. No, nobody has to sell. What? Like, there's been all kinds of rent growth. The expense side of the multifamily P&L up in the Northeast hasn't been as affected as in the Southeast, because property taxes don't reassess as often. Insurance costs have you know, they've gone up, but they haven't gone up nearly as much as they have in the Southeast. Rents are still running because, just in general, New England is an incredibly supply-constrained market, whether you're in Maine, Vermont, Massachusetts, New Hampshire. Just not profitable to build. It's challenging to build from a political environment and a geographical environment. There's just not a lot of land to build on. So, like, there's no distress up there. Like, people are still getting 2022 pricing, early 22 pricing, and it's really hard for us to do deals because we just don't fundamentally believe in that thesis up there. Now, in Florida, on the other hand, where insurance costs have gone from $500-$700 a unit to $1,500-$2,000, $2,500 a unit, like, literally doubled, and now is the biggest expense line item on the P&L, more so than property taxes, which is utterly absurd. Like, owners who are looking to sell in Florida are getting crushed. Like, there's just, between insurance and between debt and between just there being a lot of supply in the major areas of Texas and people being spooked at how much supply is coming online, that market's gotten hammered, right? So it's important to know where you in the country you are and what's going on there. So that's the big first thing. Now, in terms of what I see over the next, you know, 5 years, I don't really think that there's going to be much distress in the multifamily marketplace, and I'm speaking incredibly broadly. There will be more, you know, in the markets like Florida and Texas than there will be in the Northeast, Northwest, California, because it's just, those are less boom and bust markets, right? They're more stable markets. Same thing with the Midwest. There's going to be less movement there, but I think we will start seeing some distress into next year, but I don't think it's going to be as a result of demand, operational distress, right? I think some folks are going to have used bridge loans, and bridge loans by as a percentage of the, you know, multifamily capital stack is just less so in the Northeast. I don't know why that's the case. I think there's maybe just an abundance of local banks, regional banks. There's just a more, there's more available credit up there than maybe in the Southeast, Southwest. So not a lot of people bought deals up there with like bridge loans with floating rates. There's just less debt distress up there. So I think there'll be less so than down in the Southeast, but I think there's going to be a lot of operators, you know, a lot of the new syndicators that pulled together a couple million bucks through 20, 30 people that didn't underwrite those property tax reassessments, that underwrote significant rent growth. And as rent growth stagnates and operating expenses fly, they're going to find themselves in some challenges. But the piece of this that I think people are forgetting is there has been an incredible amount of NOI growth over the last couple of years. Like, there has been, rents have just gone up so much everywhere, literally everywhere outside of like San Francisco, where it's just going to hell, right? But throughout the rest of the country, rents have gone up so much that it has absorbed a lot of the increase in debt service and the increase in operational expenses. So I think competent operators are going to figure out a way to be okay here. But the ones that are going to find themselves in a tough spot are the ones who have loan maturities in 2024, maybe early 2025. And they're not already planning to get out of it now. Like, if they're waiting for it to get, you know, closer to that date because they're in the middle of a value add, or they're, you know, there's some other reason why they can't really do some kind of recapitalization right now, I think those are the owners that are going to see some pain. But I think long term, the fundamentals of multifamily are going to win out, especially in the markets that we're in. Like, we're really leaning into New Hampshire right now because it's so supply constrained. Because it's such a stable market. There's population growth with no new supply. Rents are continuing to stay strong. All of the fundamentals are there. And we're really comfortable that if we buy a property today, that rents either are going to maintain this, you know, the current level over 5 years, or, you know, grow a couple percent a year or something along those lines. And if we operate well in 5 years, I think we'll be in an okay position, right? I don't think that that's going to change too much because the fundamental supply and demand has not changed. We're just doing deals now with the expectation that we're not going to do anything for 5 years, right? And I think that's really important. Like, if you're an investor who's looking at a deal and it's dependent upon refinancing in a couple of years and sending some money back to your investors or sending money back to you, and even worse, if you're structuring your debt to align with that strategy, those are the folks that I think are just not really thinking right now. I think that's where we're going to see some distress in the next few years.
You know, that the interesting thing about what you're saying about the insurance and this, you know, the sellers up in the Northeast not really being in a bind, I'm seeing the same things in the vacation rental market in the Smokies, where most of my stuff is. The sellers are not really that motivated to sell because their properties are, I would say, the vast majority. There's a few where somebody maybe lost a job and the management company's not doing a good job with it, but properly managed properties up there, they're not really that motivated to sell because the property's cash flowing and it was locked in at a much lower interest rate. And they're just not feeling the pain like you would have necessarily anticipated. Like there's not necessarily blood in the streets there either. But insurance, it's gotten a lot harder to underwrite deals. Like insurance is up 40%. The last deal we just did, I got the insurance quote and I wrote them back and I said, are you sure this is correct? We just did another one and it was about 40% lower than this. And they're like, insurance has gone through the absolute roof up here. And you couple that with, they also raised taxes massively. And then interest rates, you know, a year ago were, you know, you could get some at 4%. Now you're getting it at 7%. It makes it a lot harder to underwrite deals. So the sellers got the properties on the market at what they had them at last year. And the buyers have this much tougher time underwriting. So there's just not really that much selling, you know. And you go to the seller with a low ball offer and they're not interested because it's cash flowing. They're just like, we're just going to sit here and wait. So, and you know, there will be some things that float to the top there with, if somebody maybe loses the job and the property's mismanaged, they don't have any cash to feed the property to get it through. But the vast majority are fine. So this idea that the real estate market's just going to blow up, I haven't seen it in the vacation rental market up there. It sounds like you're saying the same thing's going on in the Northeast and multifamily. And it seems like, you know, people are always saying, you know, buy when there's blood in the streets, buy when it's hard, everybody else isn't buying. It's like, you got to be careful with that because you don't just want to buy just because nobody else is buying. You need to have a good, compelling reason with your numbers when you underwrite your deal. If it's hitting your cash on cash return hurdle, then you're good, right? But if you're underwriting, you're like, man, we're off by 400, 500 grand on this. You don't want to buy it even though nobody else is buying, right?
Yeah. And the piece of this that I think is lost is that there's a difference between, you know, a bunch of folks on podcasts or online saying like, because there's less transactions, the market is tougher and therefore it's a good time to buy.
Right.
There's been 80% less transactions this year,
mm-hmm.
but which means, yeah, less properties are trading hands, but that does not mean that pricing has come down, right? We're in a bit of a messy middle right now because the market hasn't necessarily been forced to adjust to the new environment yet, as you're saying, right? All kinds of NOI growth the last couple of years. Outside of the very small percentage of investors that used moronic debt products, pretty much okay. Like there's not that much distress. So there's no reason for sellers to sell, especially those that are in a decent, you know, loan product with a decent rate, high fours, low fives, even mid fives nowadays in terms of where rates are. And I think that people think that when the market adjusts, it just crashes. Like it just goes straight down. Like the line on the graph goes right to the ground over, you know, couple of weeks, couple of months, 6 months. And in reality, it's much slower. It's like a 45 degree angle, right? And if you look at, again, we go back to the GFC, 08, that's the worst financial disaster since the Great Depression. If it's unlikely that this correction will be as significant as that one because that was mortgage based, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again, we should plan for it to be as bad, but it's unlikely that it will be that bad. But if you look at the graph, prices started to come down late 2008, and they went all the way down until 2012. That's literally more than 2 years, right? That's how long it takes to find the bottom. So yeah, I mean, it's the market hasn't even remotely started to adjust. We've been in this elevated interest rate environment now for 6, 7, 8 months. You know, they're outside of like the very rare situation where a bad operator bought overpaid for a deal and used the wrong debt, which is a very small percentage. It's not systemic. That's like one-off, right? We're probably going to see pricing start to come down through 2024, probably into 2025, right? And then maybe it starts to come back up. But it's hard to tell. I think people that think now is a good time to buy, it's not true, right? It's a good time to buy if you've underwrote 250. I mean, we're underwriting such a comical amount of deals. We're making so many offers, right? We have two deals under contract right now, only two deals we put into contract this year, which is like a tenth of the volume that we did last year. So it's just, we're finding deals that make sense, that have just an incredible return on cost and great cash flow and good debt, but we're aware that they might be worth less in a couple of years. Now we're going to have to hold for 5, 6, 7 years. So, I don't think we've reached the, you know, the bottom. I mean, it's going to be 18 plus months before we do that, probably.
Yeah. And I think I read in a book, if you're getting all your offers accepted, there's something wrong that you're doing. So if you're not getting any offers, if your volume decreases, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It may be a bad thing because it may be that you're missing out, but at the same time, it's better than getting all your deals accepted. So I want to transition to give some value to our listeners on how do we get our first multifamily property. Now, Axel, in a recent episode, you mentioned four steps, and I got it written down here, and we can talk about these, and if it's okay with you, we'll interrupt you with questions so we can have value to everybody. So number one was get educated. Number two, identifying the criteria, your buy box. Number three, learning how to find these deals. And then number four, pulling the trigger. So first one, get educated. What can you tell us about getting educated with multifamily as your first step?
For sure. So getting educated is like, we can't do anything until we actually know how to underwrite a deal, until we know how to define what a good deal is, until we're comfortable with who's going to manage it, with who's going to do the construction. And we have to get comfortable with all these different components of the process, or else we're making an irresponsible decision. And there's any kind of, resources you can use. You can listen to podcasts, right? I highly recommend listening to like multifamily specific podcasts. Getting a little bit more granular with the content that you consume as it relates to getting into the business. I think that a little bit outside of that step, but it's important to have your team built out so that you can lean on experts in each of these individual areas. Lean on an experienced insurance broker in your market. Lean on an experienced attorney. Lean on an experienced lender, right? And then the attorney is going to read the loan docs on your behalf. Lean on an experienced property management company after you close, because reduce the likelihood that you just make mistakes, right? Leverage some of the professionals along the way. And so you should have that team built out, and that's part of getting educated. The one thing I think people really need to get educated on right now is debt. Because that's like the last thing people think that they got to get educated on, right? They're like, oh, we get a loan, right? It's straightforward. You go to the bank, you get a loan. You should understand all the different components of a loan agreement. Contact a local lender, ask if you can just read a standard copy of their loan documents and ask questions like, so I understand that I have a fixed rate for 5 and then it adjusts for the 5 after that. What does that actually mean? Can you tell me what that means? I understand that I have what are prepayment penalties? When are they enforced? All of these special provisions, right? Can you walk me through that? Because debt is where really all of the money comes from. It's where, 70 to 80% of the money is coming from to buy the property. You really have to be comfortable with that. And you have to understand exactly what loan product you're getting into. And it may sound silly, but I've seen so many people get into loan products that they didn't even like understand because they just wanted to get the deal closed. And next thing they know, their rates adjusting, or they have a term that's coming up sooner, or they realize that, oh, I'm going to refinance in 9 months because I did my value add, and I have a 2-year loan, but there's a little provision in the loan docs that says I have to pay the interest for the whole 2 years, even if I refinance or sell the property sooner than that. Next thing they know, I got a huge bill. It's really important to understand your debt right now. So that's like a little subtext in terms of getting educated. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, you got to learn how to underwrite. You got to learn your debt. And you really got to, you need to understand who the best people are in your market, to help you make decisions.
That's so good information, because I know a lot of investors, most of us start with single family. And we have to understand that it's very different than single family, because for the most part, you're working, like you mentioned, with adjustable rates within a certain amount of time. So that takes care of getting educated. And one thing also you mentioned that I'll add is understanding the lingo. I know with multifamily.
That's huge. Yeah. I should mention it. My bad.
No. You're good. I mean, with multifamily, it's a whole, yes, it's real estate, but at the same time, it's a whole different beast. There's so many more metrics when it comes to multifamily. So number two is identifying your criteria. So you're in your case, you're invested in New Hampshire and also Florida.
Mm-hmm.
How were you able to come to those two specific markets?
And I think this is interesting. I take a bit of a different view to this. I think most people on podcasts, when they talk about market selection and their buy box, they're like, we buy where everybody's moving. We buy where all the jobs are going. We buy where all the path of progress. that's obviously important, right? You want to buy in a good market. I don't think you should buy in a bad market, right? That's obviously a very safe thing to say. That said, I think there's a little bit more to it. When you're getting started, you want to put yourself in a position where you're not competing with everybody, because the less people you compete with, the higher likelihood that you get a good deal, right? It seems very obvious. If you're going to start a business, do you want to start a flooring company in your local town and compete with like the retiree who's like running a flooring company and doesn't pick up the phone? Or do you want to start a software company and compete with Apple? Like, that's an extreme example, but it's the difference of competing in a market like Tampa, Florida, which is one of the hottest markets in the country, or competing a little bit farther inland in Lakeland, Florida, which is where we do deals. And that's how we started. We were like, let's go to where there's a lot of growth and a lot, you know, a really good story. And then let's expand outward into a more tertiary area so that we can compete. And we're not competing with 20 people on every deal. We're competing with 5, 6, 7 people on every deal or whatever it is, right? So I think you should start there from a competitive, you should understand the competition in the market. Right. I think step two is define your physical asset criteria. So what can you afford, right? And if you're not using your own money, what are your investors? How much money can you raise, like, back into the deal size that you can reasonably execute, and then build a buy box around that? And then you want to define the physical asset criteria. Do you want, you know, 70s built properties, 80s built properties? Do you want, you know, light value adds, moderate value adds, heavy value adds? For your first deal, I heavily advise people to not get into deals that have a very complex business plan, where you're doing a lot of construction, or you got to turn over the entire tenant base, or you're doing some kind of redevelopment. The more construction there is in a deal, the higher likelihood it is for it to go wrong. So just save yourself the pain of potentially making those mistakes and just go for a simpler deal. And that's okay if you make a little bit less money. The goal of the first couple deals is to not lose the first couple deals, and right, then you build your snowball, right? So get into something that's a little bit more simple, light value add, you know, 5K unit, 10K unit, maybe 15 a unit max, depending on, you know, where in the country you are. And then you need to thoroughly understand what constitutes a good deal in your defined geographical area and in your physical asset criteria, right? 5 to 20 unit properties in this zip code and, you know, the subset of this overall market that, you know, have a light value add strategy where the rents are a little bit low, they typically sell for what? What price per unit? You know, what's kind of the market cap rate for those types of deals? What is the demand for those types of deals? Who am I competing with? Who finances those deals? Who brokers those deals, right? You want to understand all of that thoroughly. And that all comes through just having conversations with educated folks in the marketplace. You know, those are the real estate brokers, the property management companies, the mortgage brokers, the insurance brokers, really all those folks. You just talk to all of them. Hey, what do you typically see in stuff like this trade at? Hey, you know, I saw this property sold. What did it sell for? You know, this, that, the other. And then you're like, all right, these properties typically sell for between 100 grand and 120K a unit, depending on the rents, depending on the condition, depending on the year built. And now when you're going out there to look for deals, you have the confidence to make quick decisions, which is imperative, because this game is too competitive for you to sit around and spend a few days underwriting a deal. You're just going to lose deals. And if you don't lose the deal in that period of time and there's other people looking at it, to your point, Tony, you're probably overpaying for it. Mm-hmm. So you need to be able to make quick decisions. You need to be able to underwrite quickly. You need to be able to know, like, all right, it's, you know, 22 bedroom units. The guy wants, you know, 110,000 unit. That feels pretty close, right? Let's quickly underwrite. Let's get him an LOI. Let's get going. And so you need, you know, competence breeds confidence. So you need to really develop the competence within that specific buy box.
Yeah. I mean, if you guys weren't taking notes, go back and literally grab a notebook and take notes on these items. Because I mean, Axel just dropped tons of knowledge on how to get your first deal. I appreciate it, man. That's a lot to take, but definitely something, you know, the must for you to get your first deal.
For sure.
Yeah. So you kind of covered number three and number four, which were learning how to find a good deal and pulling the trigger. So let's talk about this. Let's take you back to Axel wanting his first multifamily property. What would you advise yourself, knowing what you know now? Take time travel with me back in the day where you were sitting there before you got your first deal. What would you advise someone to do to start building momentum?
Yeah, you know, I think you just got to get the reps in. You know, I think that people drastically underestimate the volume of activity required to see results. Like, there is a massive gap in the community between, like, okay, I want to start either, you know, however you're going to find deals. I mean, I want to go get deals through brokers. I want to build good relationships with brokers, or I want to go direct to seller. Or I want to do whatever. And then, you know, there's just a drastic, I mean, difference between what people think it takes and what it really takes. And I'll give some context to this. So the first handful of deals I did were between 3 and 6 units, right? Very small, you know, even considered to be residential multifamily, right? 2 to 4 unit properties, and then small commercial multifamily, 5, 6 units. You know, I did a 7 unit, like I think it was my 5th deal in. That was like, you know, the biggest deal amongst that time, first couple of years in the business. And I think that I benefited because I had this little side hustle of buying and selling cars. And the way that I would find deals in that game was every single day I would go on Craigslist and I would literally email every single private sale and just offer them 30% under what they were asking for their car. And I got a lot of like people telling, hey, buzz off, man. I'm not doing that. I'm not selling my, you know, my $7,000 Toyota Camry for $5,000. But one in every 200 emails or 200 messages, I'd engage in a conversation, and then a smaller percentage of those, we would buy a car for $5,000 that was worth $7,000, and I'd go sell it for $7,000, make a couple grand, right? And that was like, so I was kind of trained from a sales process standpoint. So you need to look at starting your business from a deal sourcing standpoint as a sales pipeline. You need to drop stuff into the top of the funnel, and you need to work it down the funnel. And what gets stuff into the top of the funnel is an absurd amount of activity. Whatever you think you have to do, multiply it by 10, right? Like, let's, you kind of have to be insane about how much you do. And we have a full-time guy on our team now who just does acquisitions. He makes 1,000 cold calls a month. We spend $7,000 or $8,000 a month on direct mail marketing. He sends thousands of emails every month. And we do that so that we can make 30 to 40 offers a month. That's how much activity is required to make 30 to 40 offers a month on, you know, basically 10 to 80 unit properties between New Hampshire and Florida. And of those 30 offers, we expect one to get accepted. That is the amount of volume that translates to doing one deal. Granted, we have a really high return expectation. We're looking at larger deals, so it takes a little bit more volume than somebody who's going after 5 to 10 unit deals where you can, you know, maybe you can find something a little bit faster. So I think you just have to accept the level of work it's going to take. And then you have to commit to the process of it and understand that if you just do it for long enough, then the snowball really starts to grow and then everything gets so easy, right? And when you think about sourcing deals, everything is so hard for the first 3, 4, 5 deals because no one knows who you are. You have no track record. You probably aren't in a financial position to, like, you know, offer competitive terms. You know, you're scared. Like, that's a whole piece of it. You're just scared that you're overpaying, that something's going to go wrong. And then once you get to that level of competence, you got some money, things are going well, you got a little bit of a balance sheet, people know you in the marketplace, then everything just, then the pendulum swings to the other side and then everything gets easier. And I think you just have to stay in the game long enough to get to a few deals, right? To get those reps in. So if I were to go back to myself, despite the fact that I still took a lot of activity, I still took less activity than what I thought was required. And I could have done way more deals early on if I just leaned into the process more. You know, I would send around a direct mail and, you know, in February, I'd get a few calls. I wouldn't get any deals and I'd get discouraged and I wouldn't send any more direct mail until December of that, you know, 10 months later, November, whatever it was. And I was just sending it when I felt like it. And I was doing, you know, there was no process. There was no system. It was like when I had a second or when I felt like I could get, you know, some results. And in between, I was just kind of throwing crap at the wall. And I think it really helps to build a sustainable process. Like, let's say you're going to go to brokers. I'm going to use a personal CRM, HubSpot, Zoho, whatever. There's a lot of free options. I'm going to put every single active broker in my marketplace into the CRM. I'm going to reach out to 5 of them every single week. Just forever. And every time I speak with them, I'm going to take notes. I'm going to talk about, you know, I'm going to ask them some personal questions. I'm going to get to know them a little bit better. And then, you know, after I speak with them on the first of the month, I'm going to send myself a little follow-up reminder to give them a call, shoot them an email, send them a text on the, you know, in 30 days from now, 45 days from now. And you're systematizing relationship development, which people don't think you can do, but you can, right? And now I've built a process around developing top of mind quality relationships with the active brokers in my market. And so it requires that level of intentionality. You know, and we could get into what it takes on the direct to seller side, but you have to have that mental approach. You have to look at real estate as a sales and marketing business because that's what it is. It's not a, you know, real estate or a finance business. It's a sales and marketing business. And you have to think about everything you're doing in your business through that lens.
I love that. And I think that applies that concept of whatever effort you think it's going to take to do what you want to accomplish, 10x that, and that's probably about the amount of effort that it will take. That applies to everything I've done in real estate so far, as well as building my own businesses. it's just, that's just, I think how life is kind of, there's like a, almost like the matrix is coded. It's like you have to put forth a massive amount of effort to move an inch at first. And then once you start getting the momentum, you can put 1/10 the effort in and get the same results or more results because you've got momentum. And momentum is everything in real estate investing. When you've got no momentum, you'll feel like you're not moving anywhere and you're putting forth all this effort, all this time, and it's easy to get discouraged, right? But you are actually making progress because that beginning momentum and almost spinning your wheels is required to build up that first little bit of momentum to move the boulder, and then it starts rolling, right? And then you got that momentum, and now you know what you're doing. People know who you are. Deals start coming your way. You start being able to recognize a good deal easier. You build your systems out better. You become proficient at building your business. You get a deal. You learn how it works, and you become a professional at this. Then it gets a lot easier. Then you get on up the food chain, and it's like easier to raise money, easier to get take down big deals. And you look back at that first spot you were in, and it's almost like that was almost the hardest part, you know, is just getting going, getting past zero. And I think that applies to whether you're investing in single family, whether you're trying to flip a house, whether you're trying to do vacation rental. Tony's developing a mobile home park. I mean, it applies to everything. Like, you got to put in the reps. You got to 10X the effort up front to get the results you want. So,
yeah. Add one little note because it ties into what I was, you know, to what we were talking about, Tony, which is like the competence breeds the confidence, right? So if you just 10X what you do up front, if you, you know, email 20 owners that have their property up for rent and ask them, hey, are you, you know, I'm not looking to rent the property, but would you be interested in hearing an offer? I'd like to buy the property. If you just do that for a month, you're going to speak with a bunch of sellers, right? And maybe they're not interested in selling, but they'll share a rent roll with you. You'll get to know them. You can underwrite their deal quickly. You'll develop a better sense of what average rents are in that market. You'll get to know some of the owners, you'll practice your underwriting skills, you know, so all of that stuff compounds in all the different areas, right? And the people that have the hardest time getting into this business is, obviously, you want to go and increase your activity so you get deals, but the challenge becomes when you're not doing all of this stuff and you're not looking at a lot of deals, it's harder to develop the rest of the equation, right? Becoming proficient with the underwriting, you know, because every time you look at a deal, maybe, you know, you're probably reaching out to maybe your PM or your lender or mortgage broker and saying, hey, how would you size this up? Hey, and the next thing you know, it's a rising tide lifts all boats type of scenario, right? So a lot of that action leads to other things, which is great.
Man, that's so much good information out of there. I mean, I'm a believer too in the funnels. There's no, like, some people may say like, hey, Axel's lucky to get 3 deals this year. But they don't realize that behind the curtain, Axel actually is working his butt off trying to get all of these deals. There's no such thing as luck alone. There's luck and there's hard work that backs that up. And then one thing that I love to point out to our listeners is the fact that building a system, a follow-up system, whether it's with your sellers, with your private lenders, buyers, whatever the case may be, I love that. I mean, some people might say that it's not a genuine relationship, but we're busy people. We're going to forget a lot of things. And honestly, a reminder for you to follow up with somebody is, you know, creating a system around that, that is really the way to go. And that's the way you get these deals or you get these investors to invest in your business. Man, so much good knowledge that comes out of here. Axel, do you want to, I know you have a podcast. You want to tell people about what you got going on and your syndications?
Sure. Yeah. So I host the Multifamily Wealth Podcast, just 2 episodes a week, one with a guest, one just me talking about what we're learning in our business, just trying to grow a multifamily, portfolio and, great multifamily business. So I highly recommend you check it out. If you're in multifamily, you want to learn more about multifamily, our real estate business is called Aligned Real Estate Partners. And if you'd like to get on our list where we send deals and, I send a real value pack newsletter every couple of weeks as well, you can do that at AlignedREP.com/invest. And then a quick plug for something that I recently came out with. We took all of the internal training that we provide our acquisitions folks and packaged it up into a course. And we sell it. Really, my goal is to like pay for the ads so that more people can get their hands on it. Because I want to teach people how to find deals so that we can partner with folks who are finding deals to grow our multifamily business. Like, that's my end game with it. And if you want to check that out, it's multifamilywealtheducation.com/offmarket, all one word.
Awesome. And we'll include that in the show notes. So if you're driving or you got your hands occupied, just go back to the show notes to get that information as well. Axel, where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, any of those three spots. And then, you know, if you want to shoot me an email, Axel, A-X-E-L, at alignedrep.com is my email. And then I'm really active on Instagram too, at multifamilywealth.
Cool deal. And then Josiah, how about you?
Where they can find out more about me?
Yeah.
Man, if you're not following me on Instagram and not subscribed to our podcast, I'm gonna jump through this camera, this radio right now. No, I'm kidding. You guys, I know you guys are subscribed to the audio podcast, but we've also started the YouTube channel. So jump over there, stop, hit pause on this and jump over there and subscribe to the YouTube channel because we're trying to release shorts. We're trying to release a lot of content over there. Hopefully it's adding value to you. And we're going to keep trying to bring great guests like Axel on the show. So yeah, you can follow me on Instagram. It's at Daily Real Estate Investor. I'm pretty active over there. And then, of course, I've got TikTok and LinkedIn and all that stuff. You can find that. There's a link tree on my Instagram you can find. But definitely go over to YouTube. If you're not watching this on YouTube, go over to YouTube, look up the Daily Real Estate Investor channel, and subscribe to that, if you will. Like our videos. Try to share it with people. We want to get the message out. We're going to try to get some meetups together, actually get to meet people and hang out in person, do some fun stuff, and grow our businesses and stuff. But, Tony, go ahead and plug your contact info while we're doing this.
Sure. So I'm active on Instagram, TikTok at ant1234 Moreno. And you can find me there. And then all of my content, you can also find it on YouTube at the Daily Real Estate Investor YouTube channel. And before we close, man, I just want to point out, Axel, your background is like the best thing ever. I thought it was a virtual one for a second.
It's funny. I'm gonna spoil it. It's a cloth.
That's
it's not real. I'm fooling everybody.
That's
man, you fooled me. I was like, that's a perfect background right there.
That's awesome.
Oh man, appreciate that.
Also, we have, before I forget, we also have a Facebook group that you guys need to jump in and join. It's of course free, and we're trying to keep in touch with everybody about what we might, some events we might have going on coming up. So Axel, man, this has been awesome, dude. Thank you so much for your time. Stay in touch. Love to have you back on the show at some point. And Tony and I may be contacting you off podcast to, when we get our first deal under contract, if we could use you for some consulting or something. I don't know.
For sure. No, would love to chat. I appreciate the invite, guys. And you know, this was great.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Please connect with me on Instagram at Daily Real Estate Investor or via email at josiahsmelser@gmail.com. My new book titled Dream It and Build It, How to Crush Your Real Estate Investing Goals is out. You can get it either in digital or physical format on Amazon. Once you've read the book, please leave me a review. Tune in next time for another episode of the Daily Real Estate Investor as we both join in our financial freedom journey.